teenager, talk to her for a few moments, and then gently push her towards the man beside him. The girl, with the older man's hand on her shoulder, left through the back door.
"Do we go now?"
asked Max, edgily.
"Hang fire."
Rosie had seen two girls, who looked totally wrecked, approaching Cade.
"Oh, lovely. Keep it up, kids. Let's see what he does. Have you got him lined up, Max?" "Center stage. This couldn't have gone better if we'd set it up."
As they watched, the two teenagers flirted with the older man, and to Rosie's delight, he began to reciprocate. First, a kiss, then a hand on a buttock. The hand slid around the girl's tight miniskirt and began to slide beneath the shiny material.
"Gotcha, slimeball.
Time to go, all units." Rosie and Max threw their beer cans to the ground and, sidestepping the dancers, hurried forwards directly towards Cabe.
"Perhaps you'd like to come with us, sir?"
Without waiting for an answer, they bundled him backwards through the door and into the back room.
"James Cade, I'm arresting you..."
"Like hell you are!"
Cade swung around like a man possessed and flung Rosie backwards into the wall. The air rushed from her lungs and she doubled over in pain.
"Max! Don't let him get away!"
she breathed, clasping her ribs. Max hesitated, staring at her with a horrified look on his face.
"Leave me, you idiot! I'm just winded. Nail that bastard!"
It was a scene of utter chaos. Blue lights flashed. Men and kids were running in all directions, and the squeal of tires and engines joined in with the techno music that still throbbed in the old silo. Cade ran out and across the concrete backyard, towards his hidden car. Max raced after him. He was fitter and faster, but he didn't have Cade's desperation. Suddenly Cade stopped, picked up a length of wooden fence post from a pile of rubbish, and swung it straight into Max's midriff. Max went down like a wounded animal, and Cade ran on, straight into the path of Sergeant Marie Evans. Marie charged at him, taking him clear off his feet in a perfect rugby tackle. Cade hit the deck. He scrabbled desperately to get free of Marie's weight. Marie moved back slightly just enough to allow him to make another attempt to run. Then she hit him. She felt the impact all the way from her knuckles to her shoulder, and she was glad of it. She rubbed her clenched fist and stared down at the unconscious figure.
"It's not much, Val,"
she muttered, as she took her cuffs from her pocket.
"But I hope it makes you feel better. It certainly makes me feel good."
As she leant over Cade and snapped the cuffs into place, she felt the dark cloud finally lift. Until now, she had believed that Cade would never pay for the terrible things he'd done while wearing a police officer's badge. Marie stared coldly down at him.
"Let's see you try to wriggle out of this one, Chief Superintendent."
Gary was at her side.
"I hope you're right, Sarge, but I'll only believe it when I see a new name on his office door."
Still out of breath, Rosie approached, supporting the winded Max.
"Where the hell did you learn to hit like that?"
"Anger management classes, would you believe? Work's a treat."
Marie looked at her colleagues.
"And well done, you two. Great job."
Max grimaced.
"Our pleasure. I reckon it was worth a couple of cracked ribs just to see that haymaker, Sarge."
He grinned admiringly at Marie.
"Just remind me never to upset you."
"I'll second that."
Jackman stood looking at her in amazement.
"They don't call you Super Mario for nothing, do they?"
"I had something of an incentive."
"Let's clear up this mess and go home, shall we? And maybe you can tell me what that particular incentive was."
Marie smiled at him.
"I can now."
Marie sat opposite Jackman in his office, a half bottle of scotch and two glasses between them.
"I never drink on duty, but in Cade's case, I'm making an exception."
Jackman poured the whiskey. He sat back and savored the first sip, then let out a long sigh of relief.
"Talk to me, Marie.
You told me that Cade blighted your friend's career. But what did he actually do? Marie held onto her glass and stared into it. He pestered her, harassed her, belittled her, ruined every chance that came her way, and finally broke her spirit. All because she rejected his vile advances. She took a long swallow and winced as the alcohol touched her split lip. Valerie was one of the brightest recruits, full of optimism and hope that she could make a difference. She was intelligent and good-looking, but Cade wore her down. Like a lot of coppers, she would go home and have a drink after a shift, sometimes two or three, and it gradually took hold of her. Everything started to go wrong, and she knew she couldn't hack the job anymore. In the end, she threw in the towel and moved away.
Maria, I'm so sorry. I had no idea it was that bad.
She was my dearest friend. She was to have been my bridesmaid. She got on like a house on fire with Bill. She was so happy for me when Bill and I got engaged. I missed her then, and I still miss her.
Couldn't you get in touch with her? Go visit her, maybe?
She shook her head slowly. It's too late, Jackman. She got drunk one night. Several witnesses saw her stagger out into the road. Ironically, she was hit by a police traffic car on its way to an RTC. She died before she got to hospital. A tear formed in Marie's eye. And although Cade didn't physically kill her, he caused her death as surely as if he had wrapped his fingers around her throat and squeezed.
Oh, Lord, that's terrible. No wonder you hit the bastard so hard.
Marie stared at her bruised knuckles. Most satisfying thing I've ever done.
I'm sure the memory of it will live with him for years to come.
Oh, I do hope so. Clive put his head around the door. Dear Jackman, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the super wanted you to know that she needs to hold a press conference. She wondered if you would go and prepare Grace Black before this hits the media.
Jackman stretched and groaned.
Oh, dear, yes, of course I will.
I'll go with you, said Marie. I just wish we had something to tell the poor woman. But the bodies have all been named now, and there was no Kenya amongst them.
At least we can tell her that we will now be concentrating on her girl's case.
He picked up the phone.
I'll give her a ring and tell her we're on our way.
When she picked up, Jackman asked if it was convenient to call on her.
You're a bit late, Inspector. I already know there have been what I believe you call significant finds.
She gave a tired laugh.
I still have my sources.
I'm sorry that is the case. We didn't want you to hear it from others first, Mrs. Black.
I also realize that whatever you have found, it does not involve my Kenya, or you would have been knocking on my door long before this.
That is true, Mrs. Black. But Kenya will now be our number one priority.
Then you call on me when your investigation gets underway. I am fully prepared for whatever the papers and television are about to throw at us.
I wish I was, said Jackman somberly.
I'd avoid watching the news for a while if I was you.
If they were talking about my child, it would be different. As it is, I still have hope.
Jackman thanked her and rang off.
I think the poor woman is desensitized after so long.
Before Marie could answer, Gary knocked on the door and walked in, closely followed by Ted Watchman.
Good Lord, are you still with us? With everything that you have witnessed recently, I thought you would have hightailed it back to your university long before this.
Ted brushed a lock of hair off his face.
You can't get rid of me that easily, especially not when there is a mystery still to solve. I've been going over the maps and the underground surveys of Windrush, and I'm worried that we have missed something.
Jackman glanced at Marie.
I'm not sure if I can take too many more surprises.
He looked back at Ted. I'm not going to like what you're about to say, am I? Ted shrugged.
Probably not, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
Jackman felt exhaustion creep over him.
Okay. Tell us the worst.
It's the Gatehouse Lodge, at the entrance to Windrush.
Marie tilted her head to one side. but that was checked and double-checked by uniform in the initial search for Micah. All it contains is a bit of old furniture left from previous tenants, and little else. There is no cellar, and apparently the attic has several decades' worth of rubbish in it, but no signs of entry for years, going by the undisturbed dust and cobwebs. Sorry, Sergeant Evans, but I beg to differ. My geophys reports distinctly showed something below that building. I did mention it, although I thought it was a simple cellar. I thought it would have been checked as a matter of course in the police search. It was. I spoke to the officers myself. Marie looked puzzled. Can we check it out ourselves? Asked Ted. Only, careful examination of the survey shows what appears to be a short tunnel terminating there. I could be wrong, but I think it was a spur from the tunnel that the old time wreckers used. Jackman exhaled.
It's almost 1 a.m. We can't do anything until tomorrow. But if you think we need to look at this place, Ted, then we'll be guided by you. But until then, everyone home, and for heaven's sake try to get some sleep.
As they slowly packed up their things and left, Jackman decided that sleep would probably be quite hard to come by. He, for one, was still fired with adrenaline. Chapter 34
I wish we still had that heat-seeking camera, muttered Max.
Bit too pricey to have hanging around, I'm afraid, Gary said. We'll just have to use our eyeballs.
Officers were slipping silently through the trees and bushes and taking up their positions around the gatehouse. Jackman had decided that if they were to find more nasty surprises, this time they would be well equipped to deal with them. He spoke quietly to Ruth Crook, who had insisted on joining them to direct the operation.
Ted Watchman has isolated another underground area. It's much smaller, but considering the terrible things that have been going on here, there is a good chance there may be more bodies.
How is it accessed? She asked.
From a tunnel that joins the original marsh tunnel. An armed response vehicle arrived a short while ago, and a small tactical firearms unit is already in place at the entrance just in case. The uniformed sergeant in charge walked up to them and addressed the superintendent.
We are confident that the rest of Windrush is now clear, ma'am. As far as we can tell, there are no more accessible concealed places either above or below ground. The lodge had been searched, but we think that the entrance to the cellar must have been very cleverly hidden.
There have been officers in and out of that gatehouse for days now. Do you really think we missed something? Jackman looked at her.
Ted is certain, and that is good enough for me. The lad knows his stuff.
After finding what you did in the children's ward, the superintendent swallowed. Well, we know that the killer is dead and we have 2 more of the Mulberry family safely locked up, but there is no knowing what might be down there, is there? Take care, won't you?
I will be careful. I have 2 armed officers, and I'll make sure that my team is safe.
Good luck, Rowan.
We're all ready, ma'am. Everything is in place. Not even a starving cat could slide out of that place without us seeing it. We're just waiting for your orders to go in, ma'am.
Then get to it, Inspector.
Jackman went in first with Marie, Max, and Charlie. They moved around the ground floor as quietly as they possibly could. Their objective was simply to identify the position of the entrance to the cellar. They would not attempt to open it, and there would be no crashing and banging about. The most effective tool they had was their eyes. This time they had the advantage of knowing that there was a cellar. They just needed to spot the anomaly that would give the secret door away. When they finally located it, Jackman at once forgave the first search team for their oversight. It was in the hallway, a dingy and badly lit vestibule that reeked of age and neglect. 2 walls were panelled in dark wood, and the rest had a thick, badly dented dado rail, with wood panels below and damp-stained wallpaper above. There were coat hooks on one of the full panels, and a tarnished gilt-framed mirror on the other. Much to everyone's surprise, it was Charlie Button who found it. They were on their second recce of the place when Charlie stopped by one of the tall panels, looking puzzled. Then he lightly touched the panel with the coat hooks attached, and turned to Jackman, excitement sparkling in his pale eyes.
"Different texture wood, and it's fractionally proud of the wall level, sir. I think it's on a pressure spring. Push it firmly and it will spring outwards and slide along."
His voice was low, and Jackman could barely hear him. But when he touched the wall himself, he understood exactly what Charlie meant. Jackman signaled to the others, and they melted back through the open front door and into the overgrown garden. While Charlie explained the precise position of the secret entrance to the sergeant and discussed how best to execute a successful entry, Jackman wondered what might lie beneath their feet. He remembered the gruesome items that had been found in the burnt-out caravan. Wrist and leg restraints. Leather masks. He stopped himself. In a minute or two, he would have to be one of the first down into that cellar, and he needed to be ready to cope with absolutely anything. He took some deep breaths, drew himself up, and took a step forward. The operation was smooth, understated, and very effective. The door opened onto a narrow staircase. It went straight down, parallel to the hall, and ended in a small basement with a low ceiling. They saw rickety shelves with rusted paint cans, mouldering sacks, and cardboard boxes eaten away by mildew and the teeth of small rodents. The floor was littered with rubbish, and the smell of decay was overpowering. On the far wall was another door. It looked ordinary enough, with chipped paintwork and a single lock. "Take it down." Once again the metal enforcer was swung slowly back and forth, and the two armed officers waited to move forward. And then they were through. And they all halted abruptly. The room was clean. Spotlessly so. Curtains with a pretty floral pattern hung from a white curtain rod, in front of a trompe-l'oeil window. There was a bed, with a chintzy tapestry throw over it, and a small writing desk littered with pens, pencils and paper. Shelves full of books lined one wall, a collection of teddy bears sat on top of a white-painted tall boy, and a stack of colourful jigsaw puzzles stood in one corner. Over the bed, there was a picture of tiger cubs at play. A wooden frame with a string of pink fairy lights hung from it, forming a bright arch of twinkling ruby lanterns above the pink, padded bedhead. It was the last thing Jackman had expected. As he moved slowly around, trying to make sense of it, Marie touched his shoulder and nodded silently towards the far side of the room. A narrow door in concertina folds was moving very slightly. The two AFOs, bulked out with body armor and carrying automatic weapons, moved fast. For a long moment neither Jackman nor Marie dared to breathe. And then they heard a young voice call out,
"Don't hurt me! Please don't hurt me!"
The firearms officers closed in and one of them ripped back the door. They saw a bathroom, neat and compact with a proper toilet and an old short bath with a modern shower unit over it. Huddled almost underneath the bath itself was a young girl. She sat on the pink bath mat hugging her knees and looked up at them from eyes wide with terror. Jackman found it hard to stop himself from rushing forward and gathering the child up in his arms. Marie asked the question for him.
"Kenya?"
"Asher! I want Asher!"
The shaky voice was growing stronger.
"Please, find me Asher! I want Asher!"
There were procedures to follow, and they were very strict. Jackman knew that he could not just remove the girl from her home. The regulations dictated that he immediately request a specially trained child victim support unit to assess the situation. He thought all of this, but what really worried him was why the child was calling for Asher Layton.
"Door at the back of the linen cupboard, sir.
It's still open. It leads to the tunnel. We can hear noises and we're in pursuit.
The two officers crashed through the small aperture and disappeared. The girl began to scream,
"Asher! Don't hurt him! Please don't hurt him!"
Marie dropped to her knees a few paces from the hysterical girl.
"It's all right. Honestly, it's all right. We just need to talk to him. We won't hurt him."
She took out her warrant card and held it up for the girl to see.
"You understand that we are the police, don't you? We are here to help you, that's all. My name is Marie, and this is Jackman. And you are Kenya Black, aren't you?"
She smiled warmly at the child.
"I cannot tell you how pleased we are to meet you."
The girl rocked backwards and forward, avoiding eye contact, but Jackman saw her nod very slightly.
Jackman couldn't believe it. She was alive.
Kenya Black was alive.
After how many years? 8?
Almost a decade.
And she was alive and safe.
Jackman stared at her dumbfounded. She was slim and pretty, dressed in skinny jeans and a t-shirt, and apparently unharmed. Then his elation faded. He thought of the Mulberry children. He stared at Kenya, cowering on the floor and rocking backwards and forward. He knew he was out of his depth. It was time to get help. Jackman ran back up the stairs and into the hallway, shouting for a WPC to go down and assist Marie. His superintendent stood open-mouthed. Jackman knew she was as stupefied as he by what they had found in that strange little boudoir below ground.
"And you say she looks to be in good physical health?"
asked the super for the second time.
"As I said, skinny and pale. But I've seen far worse going through Sultan's school gates. God knows what state her mind is in. But physically, I'd say, she's been looked after very well."
The superintendent let out a long, breathy whistle.
"This takes some getting your head round.
I'll have to make an emergency call, Rowan. I'll get some professionals out here immediately, and well done to you and your team. This is not the kind of result anyone ever dared to even dream about."
Grace Black did. She never gave up hope, thought Jackman. Then before he could speak, he heard noises coming from the stairs, a muffled crashing and shouting. Marie had told Kenya that they wouldn't hurt Asher, but Jackman had a bad feeling that they might have done just that. He waited, dumbly, gnawing on the side of his forefinger. He really didn't want to go back down to the cellar. If Asher had been hurt, then he didn't want Kenya to know about it, not yet. The poor kid had had enough shocks.
"Sir,"
Gary hurried in through the front door of the lodge. His ashen face told Jackman everything.
"They've shot him, haven't they?"
"He's in a bad way, boss."
He shook his head.
"I was there. It was horrible. He just ran. They gave him all the warnings, but he still ran."
"But he wasn't armed, was he?"
"No. He did have something in his hand, although it didn't turn out to be a gun. For a moment I thought he would just give up. He seemed so lost and so desperate.
Then he just ran headlong at our armed officers."
Gary swallowed hard.
"Even then they tried to apprehend him, but a warning shot ricocheted off the wall and hit him in the head. I thought it was game over, but the medics say he's hanging on by a thread."
Jackman groaned, thinking of the impact this would have on Kenya Black. They didn't know the exact situation yet, but everything indicated that Asher Layton had been the only living person Kenya had had contact with for almost a decade. Then they show up and shoot him. Jackman closed his eyes and fervently wished things had turned out differently. He knew a little about the strange bond that could form between hostage and captor. Gary was looking at him.
"They say you found the girl alive, sir. Is that true?"
Despite the way things had turned out, Jackman couldn't hold back his smile.
"Yes, it's true, Gary. And believe it or not, the girl is Kenya Black."
Tears welled up in Gary's blue-grey eyes, and he wiped them with his sleeve.
"Well, I'm damned. After all this time, I just can't believe it.
He looked at Jackman.
And is she...
Amazingly, she seems fit and well. When they brought her out, go down and see her room, and where she's been living for the past 10 years. You'll be as utterly gobsmacked as I was.
It's going to be a while before we piece it all together, isn't it? I mean everything that happened to her.
Let's hope Asher pulls through. The biggest question is, why is she not dead? Cannot understand why she was not lying in a bed in the children's ward along with the others. What made her different?
Jackman shrugged.
I'd better get back down there and see how Marie is coping.
Gary, would you go to the hospital and keep a close watch on Asher Layton? If he wakes, and let's pray that he does, ring me immediately, and then write down every word he utters, got it?
On my way, boss.
As he left, Jackman called after Gary.
You said that Asher had something in his hand.
What was it?
A child's toy, sir. A little teddy bear.
Jackman breathed in slowly. When Kenya went missing, she'd had a teddy bear with her. A jointed one with arms and legs that moved. So it had stayed with her throughout her captivity. A comfort. Something she loved. And Asher had taken it with him when he tried to get away. A memento.
Chapter 35. Jackman read the memo that the super passed across her desk. Kenya Black has been taken to a safe place. She will be cared for while slowly preparing her to be debriefed about her life at the hands of her abductor. It is imperative that she be able to contextualize her experience for her own sanity and for the sake of others. All relevant information will be available to you as and when it becomes available to us. He didn't recognize the signature.
Rowan, you're something of a hero to Grace Black.
I'm no hero. My team just did their job, that's all.
I don't think that's how she sees it. There have been a lot of empty promises made to that woman over the years. Between you and me, I believe that we let her down badly. She told me that you and your Sergeant Marie were the first police officers that she actually trusted. She felt certain that you would be the ones to give her closure. The fact that you have given her back her daughter has exceeded her wildest dreams.
I just wish I knew how much is left of her daughter after all that time in captivity.
Early indications are good, Rowan.
That is the main reason I asked you up here now.
Ruth gave a rare smile.
Considering Asher Layton's psychological problems, in other words, his sex addiction, it will probably come as a pleasant surprise to hear that Kenya Black suffered no sexual abuse during her confinement. The medical examination confirms that he never touched her, not once. She's still a virgin.
Jackman thought about the room in which Kenya had been held. He certainly didn't understand it, but he believed what Ruth Crook had told him. For a while, neither of them spoke. In their job, they were always prepared to expect the very worst, and something as astonishing as this was hard to comprehend.
And the psychologists are not attributing her affection for Asher to Stockholm syndrome either. She says that he has been kind to her, and, abductor or not, he has been her whole world for most of her life.
Ruth raised her eyebrows.
She says he rescued her.
We don't know any more than that. After all, it's very early days. But it seems that, considering everything that has happened to her, Kenya is incredibly well adjusted.
So, did he rescue her from Toby Tanner, I wonder?
That is one of the first questions she will be asked. We need to piece together some sort of sequence of events. It does not look as though Asher Layton abducted her for his own ends. He certainly incarcerated her for almost a decade, but for what reason? We now know that she was not a sex toy, and on examining her clothing we suspect that he took her outside to play. There are traces of soil and plant material in the grooves of her trainers, and our officers discovered newish Wellington boots and a rain jacket in a closet. Kenya is alive, and 12 others are dead. Why? Jackman mused.
Bizarre, isn't it?
Kenya obviously never entered that nightmare of a caravan, and Philip never took her on that awful last trip down the tunnel to the children's ward. Maybe I need to speak to Philip again, ma'am. He could know something about this, although I'm pretty certain that Asher was the only person who knew that the little girl was there.
I agree, but go ahead and talk to him if you want.
It's Asher I'd really like to talk to.
Wouldn't we all? But he's still hanging between life and death. I'm afraid it will have to be Kenya herself who tells us her story.
Which will take time, added Jackman.
Ruth Crook tilted her head.
I'm not so sure. She's already talking, something nobody expected.
She's confused and fragile, but she's not in serious traumatic shock as she would have been if she'd been regularly assaulted. It's almost as though she believes she has led a perfectly normal life, and only now has found out that it was quite different to that of other children.
He did keep her mind stimulated. You could tell from the things in that room. Games, toys, puzzles, and books by the score. Jackman drew in a deep breath and let it out very slowly. I'm still having trouble getting my head around the fact that she is actually alive. Her case has been in the background for a decade. Most of us believed that her mutilated body would turn up one day simply by chance. No one imagined that she would one day walk unaided out of her own little underground world.
When I asked you to tie this case up once and for all, never in a month of Sundays did I think it would end like this.
As Jackman reached for the door handle, Ruth Crook added,
I forgot to mention, Chief Superintendent Cade is moving to another county, somewhere out near the Welsh borders, I believe.
Jackman froze. His hand still gripped the cold brass handle. He's getting out of it. The bastard.
I never heard that, Rowan, but it's the best we could hope for.
It wasn't the best that he could have hoped for. Jackman had hoped that the evil sod would be hung out as food for the vultures.
How did he manage that? He asked through gritted teeth.
He declared to the investigating officers that he had deliberately infiltrated the club in the hopes of bringing in the men at the top. He said that you and your team ruined his undercover operation.
Jackman swallowed hard and felt his cheeks grow hot. But there was hard evidence. Forensic evidence, photographs, witnesses.
Nothing that would hold up in court. And some of the things that you mentioned don't seem to exist anymore.
Ruth seemed to deflate as he watched.
He's a powerful man, and a dangerous one, Rowan. As I said, the outcome is the best that we could hope for, and I suggest you leave well alone.
Jackman thought about how devastated Marie would be at the news. He quietly said,
So some other poor innocents in a different area get the benefit of his filthy attentions.
Maybe not, the super smiled like the Mona Lisa. He's not the only one with friends in high and low places.
The smile broadened.
I have taken it upon myself to put a few influential people in the know, so to speak. If you check the Police Gazette, I would be expecting to see news of an early retirement in the next few weeks. It's not the result you would have liked, Rowan, I know, and it's far from what he deserves. But at least it will remove him from a position of influence on the force. It's the most I can achieve without opening Pandora's box.
Jackman relaxed his grip on the door handle. He knew how things worked.
Thank you, ma'am.
My pleasure. Believe me.
Marie listened to what Jackman had to say, then gave him a resigned smile.
I should have known that whatever I did, it wouldn't be enough. Not with a snake like that.
If Ruth Crook is true to her word, and I believe she will be, that man will not be able to glance out of a window without spotting someone from Vice looking back at him.
I hope he burns in hell.
Ditto, said Jackman, picking up his phone. Gary?
Yes?
Yes.
Right. Excellent. We'll see you in 10.
He stood up.
Asher has regained consciousness and he wants to see us.
They ran down to the yard and in less than 10 minutes were looking down at the sleeping form of Asher Layton.
The doctors say he's very lucky, Gary whispered. The damage was not as severe as first thought, and since he woke up, all he has done is ask about his sister. Which one? Elizabeth or Fleur? Asked Murray. Kenya. He says that she is his baby sister.
They sat at the bedside, waiting for Asher to wake up. Jackman grinned at Gary. We've been told that Harlem Marsh Police Station has hung out the bunting and is planning a massive party now that Kate is gone. But I was rather hoping that you might like to stay on here, in Sultan Le Fen. Gary broke into a smile.
Really?
There's a place for you and our team, if you'd like it. Before Gary could answer, Asher moaned and opened his eyes.
She is safe, Asher, Jackman said softly. Kenya is being cared for, and she's perfectly safe now.
Tears fell from the young man's eyes.
That's good. That's good.
She says you saved her. Is that right?
Asher gave an almost imperceptible nod.
From Toby.
He found her playing on a beach. He brought her back to Windrush. But I saw him.
Asher swallowed loudly.
So you took her and hid her away?
My sister Fleur died, and I missed her so much. I was only a baby, but I remembered her, and I always loved her. She had such a terrible life. I thought that the same was going to happen to Kenya, and I couldn't let that happen, could I?
Tears flooded down his cheeks. One of the nurses bustled in, declaring that her patient should rest. Jackman stood up.
We've heard enough.
I'm so tired,
yawned Marie.
I'm exhausted, Gary added. Is it any wonder?
Jackman shook his head.
Who in their right mind would choose to do this job?
We would,
said Marie and Gary in unison. Jackman just nodded. Epilogue. Jackman and Marie walked across the marsh at Roman Creek. Apart from the wind rustling the reeds and the cries of the seabirds, all was quiet. No one sang beneath the ground, and no one ever would again. The tunnel had been sealed, closed up forever by experts using a very large amount of hardcore best-quality cement.
I cannot believe that a year has gone by, can you?
Marie pushed a hand through her thick chestnut wind-blown hair.
I don't know about that. All I know is that I'm still wading through the sodding paperwork.
Jackman looked back to where the brooding old Victorian Gothic house called Windrush had once looked out over the marsh towards the wash. Jackman leant back against an old weather-worn cattle trough and gazed out to where the horizon met the sky.
Speaking about reports,
Ruth Crook heard from CID at Harlem Marsh just before we came out. One of their crews had a shout to a small fire in a deserted old public house on the edge of the marsh. When they broke in, guess what they found?
Go on, surprise me.
Jackman smiled.
Let me just say that the beer cellar had been used for other purposes.
He gave a little nod of satisfaction.
The last missing link, I believe. It completely ties in with Tony Clarkson's description of the place she and Emily were abducted from.
Forensics will confirm, but it's almost certainly the missing drinking club venue. Marie grinned.
I knew we'd find it one day.
Well, it's taken a while, but now that whole nasty episode is finally sewn up. Jackman smiled grimly.
And about time, too.
His eyes widened.
But hey, have you seen the memo regarding Asher Layton?
Marie puffed out her cheeks.
Now, if ever there was an argument for karma, that's it. A man with a serious addiction to risky sex takes a bullet in the head. Against all the odds, he survives, only to find out that he has totally lost his libido.
If he wasn't partially paralyzed and spending a very long time in a secure psychiatric hospital, it would be really funny.
Something the report didn't mention was the fact that Kenya was encouraged to write to him. Grace Black told me.
It was decided that if all ties were severed, she would have to go through a full-blown grieving process. And on top of everything else, it could have been the straw that broke the camel's back. So, she writes.
Well, she's confirmed what he told us about saving her from his psychopath brother, Toby. Asher seemed to lose touch with reality at that stage. If he'd gone to the police, he'd have been a hero.
And his brother would have been locked up in a tiny space, just like when he was a child. Asher couldn't let that happen again. And although I'm sure he'll never tell us, I think he saw an opportunity to try to recreate the perfect childhood with Kenya, something he never had with his real brothers and sisters. Grace says she signs her letters, Little Sis, and I think he honestly wanted for them both to be happy. To be a proper little family. I believe that's why he never touched her.
Sounds about right. As long as he got his jollies elsewhere. The evidence that was taken from her room showed lots of children's games for two, all well-worn and apparently well-loved. He taught her to read, for heaven's sake. And from the waste left there, it looks as if he even tried to make sure she ate well.
And they did go outside sometimes. Kenya confirmed that. It must have been when Micah was not working on Windrush, and when Asher knew that Toby was busy on his farm.
Sounds almost idyllic, if you ignore the fact that Grace Black and her family were torn to shreds by his actions. Her marriage failed, and she lived in purgatory for all those years. He saved Kenya, and condemned her mother to hell on earth.
Which is why he is in secure psychiatric care, Jackman frowned. It's a wonder that Philip never saw them. He said that he went out to Windrush every single day.
He spent his time below ground, and you wouldn't see the lodge house from the tunnel entrance. Asher would have been very careful indeed with his little sister.
Marie looked back towards the end of the marsh path.
We've got visitors.
Four figures were making their way towards them. I thought the team should be all together out here for one last look around. Marie looked at him.
Why?
Wait for the others and I'll tell you. He watched as a black-and-white oyster catcher winged its way low over the lagoons. Marie waved at Max, Rosie, Charlie and Gary, trudging along the uneven path. Jackman and Marie noticed that Rosie and Max were holding hands.
So, where's the picnic?
Asked Max.
Boiled eggs and pork pies? Love 'em.
Sorry, guys, the pork pies are off. Will this do?
Jackman leaned down and took a bottle of champagne from a bag at his feet. He pulled out six clear plastic glasses and offered the bottle to Marie.
You do the honors, Sergeant.
When everyone had a drink in their hand, he raised his in a toast.
To you all, I can't begin to thank you for all the work you've put in over the last 12 months.
As the salty sea breeze caressed their faces, they touched glasses and drank.
Why here, sir? Asked Rosie.
I like fresh air and all that, but this usually happens in the CID room.
Because in a few months' time, this area will be gone. This part of Roman Marsh is to become a marina. The old sanatorium site is to be razed to the ground, and Hobbs End Marsh will be flooded to give waterway access to the new moorings and boatyard.
Best thing ever, Gary exclaimed. This marsh has been a place of fear and death for far too long. My sister would have been thrilled.
Suddenly Marie's eyes narrowed.
Then someone has made a killing, so to speak, selling off all that land. Can I guess who it is?
You won't need a second guess. Benedict Broom is a very wealthy man.
Jammy git, muttered Max.
Still, you have to hand it to anyone who can come through something like that more or less unscathed.
Unscathed.
Jackman looked across the marsh and followed the flight path of some pink-footed geese. He remembered Philip Grove saying, "We are all damaged. We all have secrets, each one of us." As they walked in comfortable silence back to the sea bank, Jackman wondered about the capable Benedict Broom. Philip had been their physician and their healer, but Benedict had been the one they turned to for answers. Benedict sorted the problems. Benedict found ways to provide for them, protect them, and bring them back to the fold. So Benedict was the fixer.
which left only one mystery unsolved, as far as Jackman could make out. The murder of Charlotte and Simeon Mulberry. Had Benedick fixed that, too? Jackman breathed in the salty, ozone-laden air and shook his head. Maybe it was finally time to close the book and let sleeping dogs lie. This has been an Audible Studios production of Their Lost Daughters, written by Joy Ellis, performed by Richard Armitage. Copyright by Joy Ellis, 2018. Production copyright, 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.